Hello, and welcome to the third session of this four-part retreat, where we are together learning more about how the ancient Celtic Church celebrated Advent. In this penultimate session, Brother Cassian encourages us to reflect on the coming of Christ at the end of all things. He prompts us to think about those people in our own lives who have had an impact and influence on our spiritual formation, before sharing two monastic Celtic practices to help us to live lives that inspire other people. For more information about Brother Cassian, who led this retreat, you can visit our website at monasticretreats.co.uk/the cloister. The final part of this retreat will be released a little earlier than usual, so you can enjoy it before the rush of Christmas. May this episode be a place of calm and peace in your Advent season.
I will give a very brief recap of the last couple of weeks first, and then step into the thoughts for this evening. So the first 2 weeks were focused on the first two comings of Christ. So the first one is the incarnation, the coming of the ineffable divine into a human body, the thing that we're all focusing on at our lead up to Christmas, the thing that we all celebrate and worship and go along to services and plays and things about that birth of Christ incarnate. And then last week we looked at the second coming of Christ, which was of course the coming of Christ into our lives, and that isn't just a one-off moment for the Celtic Christians. That was a regular, continual, present tense kind of coming into our lives, into every day of our lives. And so we come now to the third coming of Christ, which in the Bibles that you probably read is called the second coming of Christ. But of course, we've already had two, so this must be the third one. But this is the focus of Christ coming back at the end of all things. So in the early church, the very early church, the idea of Christ coming back was a very prominent, very imminent kind of focus and thing to think about. The early church, and you can see this in the early writings of Paul, really believed that Christ was coming back after the ascension within their lifetime. So if you read the letters of Paul, the apostolic letters of Paul, in chronological order, because in our traditional New Testament, they're not in chronological order. So either look at the dates and read them in chronological order, or I've got a Bible that's been created, so all the books are in chronological order. If you read them, what you discover is that in the beginnings, at the early stages of Paul's letters, you can really tell that he's kind of saying, not directly, but he's saying to the people, don't worry about life, don't worry about stuff, because Jesus is coming back again. And Jesus is coming back in our lifetime. So don't worry about getting married. Don't worry about work. Don't worry about all this kind of the stuff that happens in the world, because Jesus is coming back. Now, of course, in our Bibles, we only have one side of the conversation. It's a bit like listening to a telephone conversation just at one end. We don't really know what the other side is saying. We can kind of have a guess because of the side that we are listening to. But when we read Paul's letters, we only have one side of a conversation, because Paul's letters are all responses to the churches that are writing to him, saying, this is happening. How do we deal with this? This is going on. Our people are doing this. What do you suggest? And it's quite obvious if you read them in chronological order that there was some point that the churches were writing to Paul saying, Paul, Jesus doesn't seem to have come back. People are dying. And we're getting old now, and people, you know, the stuff is happening in the world, and Jesus hasn't come back. What should we do? And it kind of gets to a point in Paul's letters where he thinks to himself, well, maybe we do need to focus on life. Maybe we do need to look at how to live. So we then get to the letters of Paul where he talks about marriage and he talks about getting on with life, because maybe Jesus isn't coming back imminently, but we still have to be ready. And so in the Celtic tradition, the idea of the return of Christ at the end of all things was very much in that vein of, this is very imminent. This is going to happen at any point. And of course it can. You know, it can happen before, well, in my time zone, 7:15 this evening. It could happen. Whilst I'm in the midst of a conversation with you here, looking at you on a screen, and then suddenly I'll see you in heaven. That's the kind of understanding that Christianity has had for the 2,000 years of its life. And the parables that Jesus told about it, particularly one about the 10 bridesmaids or the 10 virgins, depending on which translation of the Bible you read, really speaks deeply about that idea that our life has to be in a sense of perpetual preparedness to be able to receive Christ when he comes back, when he returns. So the parable of the 10 bridesmaids is a very interesting parable. So it was a pretty typical way of doing things where the groom to be would go to the family and propose to the bride to be. And he'd say something like, so at my family home or my family homestead, there's a lot of space. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back there and I'm going to go and prepare a place for you or for us. So they would either go back to their father's house or their family home and create a space in the home, or they would actually literally physically build an extra home or an extra extension to the house in the property and the land around that. So they would physically go back and build a home for them. And the groom to be would say, I'm going back to my father's house to prepare a place for you. And then I'm going to come back and I'm going to get you and we'll go and be married and live there. You may recognize that from a statement that Jesus said to his disciples, that in my father's house, there are many rooms and I go back to prepare a place for you. That was actually a very traditional, very typical kind of thing that a groom to be would say to the bride to be and their family. So then there's this parable about 10 virgins or the 10 bridesmaids, where five of them have extra oil because the groom was later, you know, taking him longer. There'd been, you know, some problems with the building that, you know, come across water pipes or whatever it is, you know, what it's like when if you've ever done any kind of building or an extension, it's always longer than you anticipate. And five of them hadn't brought enough oil with them, so they ran out and their lamps went out and they couldn't go back in to the wedding feast. So the bridegroom then came back and the five who had spare oil were able to go straight in, but the other five were still down the shops buying new stuff or, you know, somewhere getting more oil. By the time they came back, the door was closed. Now, the interesting thing is that when Jesus told this story, all 10 of these bridesmaids were representations of people inside the Jewish faith. This wasn't people who were in the Jewish faith and people who were out of the Jewish faith. Whereas, you know, I kind of have been taught in certain Christian circles before in my past that these bridesmaids were these people who were in the Christian faith and out of the Christian faith, people who accepted Jesus and people who didn't accept Jesus. When Jesus told this story, all of these bridesmaids were in the Jewish faith, but some of them got in and some of them didn't, because some of them were prepared and some of them weren't. And the Celts really took this idea to heart that we have to make sure that our life is prepared for when Jesus comes back again. So the question then arises, of course, how do we prepare ourselves for Jesus's return? If Jesus is going to come back and the possibility of the imminence has always got to be there, how do we prepare ourselves to be ready for that? So what the Celts seem to have come up with as an answer is that our life and the way we live and our desire to want to walk the path that God lays before us, that divine path that unfolds before us, our desire to walk that and the life that we live and the intentionality behind it and the authenticity of our life towards our faith, and we'll read one particular passage that leads into that. That's what's important. The readiness of the bridesmaids was because they had stuff in preparation. So our life, the way we live, is the preparation. So I want to read a couple of passages from the Celtic Advent book that lean into this. I'm going to read two passages about two Celtic saints, a Welsh one and an Irish one. If you're going through the book, then you would have already read the first one, and the second one is tomorrow, so I'm going to spoil it for you a little bit. You'll have the same reading tomorrow doing it yourself. But the first one comes from December the 11th, just in case you want to read along. So the life of Saint Bino is what we're talking about. Now, some of you in the British Isles, or maybe some of you from further afield, may have gone to or be familiar with the St. Bino's Centre, which is in Wales, which is an Ignatian spirituality centre. But St. Bino was a Welsh saint. St. Bino, as he lay on his deathbed, he had a vision of heaven opening up above him. He saw the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and some of the apostles and other characters from the Bible and angels. And in the midst of the angels, he says, this is a quote from his life, "I saw seven angels standing before the throne of the highest Father and all the fathers of heaven singing, 'Blessed is the one you have chosen and have received and who shall dwell with you always.' I hear the cry of the horn of the highest Father summoning me and saying to me, 'My son, cast off your burden of flesh. The time is coming and you are invited to share the feast with your brothers that shall not end. May your body remain in earth while the armies of heaven and the angels bear your soul to the kingdom of heaven, which you have merited here through your works.'" Bino was invited into the wedding feast, to the heavenly party, as he lay there dying. He was a holy man who planted many monastic centres and churches, but more than this, he helped the poor, as well as leading kings to know Christ. In the life of Bino, we hear three times of him raising people from the dead by placing their decapitated heads back on their bodies. The life of Bino is short, as the writer felt that he didn't want to go on too much about how holy and amazing Bino was, in case the book should seem long-winded, so the author said. But the biographer does tell us this. Bino performed all the commandments of God. He gave food and drink to anyone who was hungry or thirsty, clothing for the naked, lodging for the stranger. He visited the sick and those in prison. He performed every good thing that Holy Scripture tells us to do. Bino's life of doing good and following what God told him to do, of going where God told him to go, and of fully obeying the word of God was the preparation for the heavenly party. The second person I want to talk about is St. Brigid. And that's tomorrow's reading, if you're following in the book, December 16th. Brigid was born in Ireland to a noble family. As she grew to maturity, she worked churning the cow's milk to make butter. One day, when she was doing so and had filled the containers, some poor wayfarers passed by. Brigid, always loving to follow the laws of God over human rules, gave away the butter that she had churned to the poor. When the day was over, a short time later, and it came to the time to present what she had made, Brigid opened her container, expecting to have to explain why hers was empty, only to find that it was full as it was before she had given the butter away. On another occasion, when she was getting food ready for guests, she was moved with compassion to feed a stray dog with some of the pork which had been cooked for visitors. When the time came to serve the guests their meal, it was found to have a full cut of pork in the pot. When she had a centre of her own, some lepers, knowing of her generous spirit and compassion, came to her asking for some beer, which was a medicine as well as just an enjoyable drink. But Brigid did not have any beer to give them. Moved by compassion for them, she saw baths filled with water, over which she prayed. The water in the baths turned to beer, and she gave the lepers not only the drink they wanted, but an opportunity for Brigid to show great hospitality to them also. I've tried that a couple of times. It hasn't worked yet. One time, Brigid in her own community was visited by a woman and her 12-year-old daughter who had been dumb since birth. The young girl approached Brigid, and we are told this. Brigid, who was joyful and welcoming to all, encouraged her with words seasoned with divine salt. And following the example of our Saviour, who commanded the little children to come to him, she took the daughter's hand in her own, and not knowing that the girl was dumb, asked her what it was that she desired. The girl's mother told Brigid that the girl was dumb and would not be able to answer. Brigid, however, told the girl's mother that she would not let go of the girl's hand until she gave an answer. Bridget then leaned gently towards the girl again, and with a smile, asked the girl again what it was that she wanted. The young girl immediately replied, "I wish to do only what you desire of me." The girl spoke from then on without any difficulties at all. And from the life of Bridget, it says, the number of Bridget's miracles increased daily, so that they are now almost beyond counting. So many acts of pity and righteousness did she perform, answering the needs of the poor, whether it was convenient to do so or not. Now, these two examples of the lives of Bynarr and Bridget, the Welsh and Irish saints, I picked those specifically because they are an excellent pair of examples of the lives of the saints doing the things that Jesus tells us in another parable, that is how we prepare ourselves, how we make sure that our life is in the right place. And that passage is Matthew 25. It's called the sheep and the goats in most Bibles. And it's the passage of the Bible that I put in the daily reading for Bino back on December the 11th. And what Jesus says in that parable is that those people who clothed the naked and fed the hungry, visited the prisoners and healed the sick, and whatever we did, whatever those people did, for those people, the least of those people, they did it for Christ. This is Jesus saying, I am present in the people, in the poor. And the life that these two lived was both a life of deep, intentional, internal relationship with the divine, which was poured out through expressing the divine love towards the poor and those less fortunate. So you can see actually that the three comings of Christ lead on one to the other, which is why I put the first coming of Christ right at the beginning of Celtic Advent and not at the end. I've had a couple of people say to me, why didn't you put the incarnation at the end? So we're reading it just before Christmas. It's because they lead on one to the other. The incarnation is about our understanding and acceptance of what it meant for the divine to come into this world. And once we grasp that sense of the divine becoming human, so the human can incorporate the divine, we are then able to embody that in ourselves, inviting Christ into our own lives. And the purpose of inviting Christ into our lives on a daily basis is for us to then live that out as an outflowing of that divine presence and divine love coming into us. It then flows out of us into the world. And the preparation that these saints had, the lives that they lived, was simply an outflowing of the divine presence and the divine commands, as it often says, that they followed all of God's commands. That is helping the poor, basically. Social action, social justice. Miracles, absolutely, there's lots of those. Spiritual things happening as well. But lots and lots of focus in the lives of the saints of helping the poor. One of the other focuses is the life of St. Aidan. I'm going to read something of St. Aidan in a moment, which is actually from today's reading in the Celtic Advent book. But one of the things that Aidan was quite famous for in his life story was taking some of the money that had been given to the monastery on Lindisfarne, going to the slave markets and buying the freedom of the slaves, buying the slaves and then giving them freedom. And then giving them the choice. He's saying either here's a bag of money and you can go and live your life now, or you can come back to the monastery with us and we will teach you to read and write and give you a trade. Now, it seems that the majority of them chose to go back to the monastery, learn to read and write and learn a trade, because a bag of money would do nothing for a freedom, a slave that's just been given its freedom, because they'd have nowhere to go. They'd have no one to talk to, or to, they wouldn't know anyone. So most of them seem to go back to the monastery. But this is the acts of the Celtic saints, the helping of the poor. So this is the flowing out of that divine love, the preparation of that life. Now I'm going to read something of St. Aidan that Bede wrote. And that is basically Bede's description of Aidan as a person. That comes from December 15th, which of course is today. And this is the kind of person that, so Bede was talking to people that knew Aidan personally when he was writing this. This is what we get from him. So it says, Bishop Aidan, a man of outstanding gentleness, devotion, and moderation, who had a zeal for God. Such were his love of peace and charity, temperance and humility. His soul, which triumphed over anger and greed, and at the same time despised pride and vainglory. His industry in carrying out and teaching the divine commandments. His diligence in study and keeping vigil. His authority, such as became a priest, in reproving the proud and the mighty. And his tenderness in comforting the weak and relieving and protecting the poor. To put it briefly, so far as one can learn from those who knew him, he made it his business to omit none of the commands of the evangelists, the apostles, and the prophets, but he set himself to carry them out in his deeds so far as he was able. All of these things I greatly admire and love in this bishop, and I have no doubt that all this was pleasing to God. Aidan taught the clergy many lessons about the conduct of their lives, and the best recommendation of his teaching to all was that he taught them no other way of life than that which he himself practiced among his fellows. So this was Bede's description of Bishop Aidan, this incredible accolade that he was given. The life that Bede lived was inspirational to so many people. In fact, there were a lot of the Roman bishops who disagreed fundamentally with some of the theology of the Irish saints, the Celtic saints, who had such a reverence for Aidan that they didn't want to conflict with his understanding and his teaching. So they kind of stepped back and allowed Aidan to teach whatever Aidan wanted to teach. But then what we learn is after Aidan died, these things that they disagreed with, when the next bishop came along and the one after that, the Roman bishops decided to take it up and have umbrage out loud. But they had such reverence and respect for Aidan because he was such an incredible person, according to Bede and those that knew him, Bede says. But the thing that I pick up the most in that accolade is that last statement that Bede makes of Aidan. He says, the best recommendation of his teaching to all was that he taught them no other way of life than that which he himself practiced among his fellows. And this is a key element. We have a phrase in our English language, a little colloquialism, that we should practice what we preach, and that we can very often pick out people who preach about stuff that don't live the life. They don't walk the walk when they're talking the talk. That we should practice what we preach. But it seems here that what Bede is saying is actually Aidan twisted that around. And it's not that he practiced what he preached. Actually, it's that he didn't preach anything that he didn't already practice. And that's quite significantly different. That actually he embodied things first before he told others that they should embody it. He didn't practice what he preached. He only preached what he practiced. And this is such a wonderful thing for us to grasp hold of. So he was an inspiration to so many people. Bino and Brigid, their lives were inspiration to people. This is what the lives of the saints were written for, to inspire people. It's a very modern concept to write a biography of someone to be purely historically accurate. The purpose of the lives of the saints up until about the 17th or 18th century, the purpose of the lives of someone was to inspire the readers or the hearers to live a better life because they heard of the life of someone who was inspirational. So what I want to do now, David, I hope this is all right, because you'll have to be in control of this, is just for about 5 minutes to go into maybe two or three breakout rooms. I'll stay out of the breakout rooms and talk about who it is in your own spiritual journey that has inspired you. So just about 5 minutes in breakout rooms, just to talk about who is it that inspires you or has inspired you on your spiritual journey. And then we'll come back together in about 5 minutes. That's okay, David. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Thank you. So what I want to do just for a moment is to just pause for a couple of minutes in ourselves, maybe just mute yourselves for a moment. And I just want us to express gratitude up to the divine or to the divine for the people who have been a part of your journey, an inspiration on your journey, whether that be someone from ancient history or someone that you've known personally. But what I want you to do is we're going to sit in silence for a couple of minutes. But I want you to express gratitude just from your heart. I don't want you to use any words, internally or externally. No words, no cognitive thought, no internal verbal gratitude. I just want you to feel gratitude and open that out and express that towards the divine. So just spend a couple of moments in silence doing that. I would encourage you to regularly express a sense of gratitude for those who have inspired you on your journey. So I want to, for the next few minutes, talk about how we might live that out. We've been inspired by others who have lived great lives and who are great examples, who either practice what they preach or only preach what they practice. But how does that change who we are, and how do we best make sure that our life is something that maybe can be an inspiration to others, or at least is on the right tracks for our own preparation for the coming of Christ at the end of all things? So I want to suggest two things that come from Celtic history to be able to do that, something that is also expressed in a number of new monastic communities and orders, but particularly those who are Celtic inspired, like the community of Aidan and Hilda, which is what I belong to. So the first thing is living by a rule of life. So obviously all monasticism is based around the monastic rule. Now, whether that's becoming a first order monastic and actually move into the monastery, or whether it's joining a third order or a new monastic dispersed community, whatever that is, all of them are based on having a rule of life. Now, in the community of Aidan and Hilda, we've changed some of the wording from traditional monasticism, because the words from traditional monasticism mean something different in our modern context. So we've changed some of the phraseology from traditional monasticism. And the word rule is one of the things that we've adjusted, because nowadays when people think of rules, they generally think of the authoritarian structure that sets up the do's and don'ts of how to be. So we think of school rules, or we think of legal rules. And if you break the rules, you get into trouble. But that's not what the monastic term rule meant. And so in the community of Aidan Hilda, we don't talk about our monastic rule, we talk about our monastic way of life. Because in a monastic context, the rule was actually a framework for a way of life. That's what was meant by a monastic rule. That's what's still meant by a monastic rule. It's just that most people think of authoritarian rules when the word rule is used. So the framework for a way of life is what we can learn from monasticism. And I think that's incredibly important, because there is so much in our modern culture that can distract us from the way we want to be, and can draw us off from our desire to want to be holier, to want to be closer to God, to want to be a better person or a better expression of the divine. So many things that can draw us off, that actually having a way of life is one of those things. Now, there's a statement by someone called Pelagius. You may know him from, most famously, he's put down in life as a heretic because he disagreed with Augustine of Hippo over a couple of issues, and Augustine had him classed as a heretic. Finally, it took him three goes to have him classed as a heretic. But and then for about the next 1500 years, the only history we knew of Pelagius was written by Augustine. So it was a little bit biased. But other stuff has come to light in the last 200 or 300 years on Pelagius. So things have started to change. But one of the things Pelagius did, as well as going against Augustine on certain things, was write apostolic letters. And some of those letters still survive, and quite a few of them still survive. And one of the things he talked about was this idea of a way of life or a rule. And he said this about having a rule. This comes from December 10th, so you would have already read this recently. In a single day, we make so many decisions that we cannot possibly weigh up the good and evil consequences of each decision. We're liable to make foolish and wrong decisions. For this reason, we need a rule, a simple set of moral principles that we can apply to each decision that we make. This will not be a foolproof thing, but with a good rule, our decision will far more often be right than wrong. Another reason for a rule is this. Jesus tells us to pray always. Yet sometimes we love to devote much time to prayer, whereas at other times we are dry or feel far too busy to pray. A rule prevents us from making excuses. It spurs us to pray at a particular time, even when our heart is cold toward God. So here Pelagius talks about a couple of points where life can be helped by having this rule, having this framework, having this way of life created and set up. And one of the things he says is that a way of life or a rule can help us make better decisions, because we've kind of already set the structure and the framework about how we want to live. So when a choice comes to us, we've kind of already got the direction that we want to face in front of us. It's already there. So the likelihood is that we're going to make a better decision because we've already got this idea on how to live set up and written in front of us. And the other thing that he says is that it spurs us on to be devoted, even in times where we feel cold towards God. So there are some times where we feel fantastically drawn towards wanting to be a spiritual person and towards God. And there are other times, whether that's because we're too busy or whether it's because we're just having a bad time. You know, we might be shouting at God over something at the moment, or annoyed at God or something, or well, something's not happened and you're in a bad place. And so it's very easy for that sense of the connection with God to wane. But what Pelagius says, and what numerous other monastic teachers say, and not just in Celtic Christianity, but in other traditions too, is that with a rule, what we do is we devote and we can commit ourselves, particularly Pelagius mentions here the hours of prayer, what the monasteries called the hours of prayer, is that we set up specific times in the day where we're definitely going to stop and pray. That doesn't stop you praying any other time of the day as well, being spontaneous, but we deliberately pepper and punctuate our days with specific times we stop every day. And I have found this incredibly helpful, because there are times where I just don't want to stop and I don't want to talk to God and I don't want to, you know, engage in this stuff. But actually, I've committed as part of a monastic community, as part of an order, I've committed to say these to stop at these punctuated times in the day. And I have found that so helpful. I can think of times in my memory where I have not wanted to do that. But by the time I've got to the end of a prayer time, because I've intentionally stopped, I feel so much better. It's a bit like physical exercise. So what we're talking about here, what a framework is, what a rule is, what a way of life is setting up spiritual exercises. And that's what they're called in some traditions. The desert tradition particularly calls them spiritual exercises. Ignatius called them spiritual exercises about 1,000 years after the desert tradition was going on. And so these exercises is a bit like physical exercise, where if we set up a regime where we write down when are we going to do what, then we are much more likely to keep to it than if we kind of just go, well, you know, I think I'm just going to go for a run every day. And there'll be times when either you don't feel like going for a run, or it's raining or snowing, or it's minus 10 degrees like it's been here for a couple of days. And we go, I don't really want to go out. But if you've set yourself a regime, and maybe even you've got yourself a fitness coach who set your regime, and that's actually going to hold you to account. Did you go running? Or maybe you've joined a running group. You know, so you're much more likely to continue doing the running if you've joined a group where people are relying on you to turn up, or people are expecting you to turn up, or maybe they're even knocking on your door and saying, are you ready? Let's go. So these things are really helpful to ensure that our life stays on the track that we want it to stay on. Setting up this framework is really helpful. And of course, in a monastic context, you're doing that alongside other people. Other people are doing the same thing with you. And that's really inspiring too. A way to keep you doing that is because you know other people are doing it. Even in a dispersed community like the one I belong to, I know that others are doing it too. And I know that I'm going to be held to account as well, because I've given permission to some people to say, are you doing it? And we review our way of life each year. And so we send this kind of review to one of the what we call guardians. And say, am I doing this? What have I been doing? How am I going? You know, what have I been struggling with? What have I found helpful? And the second thing I wanted to look at, which kind of follows on from that, interestingly, as if I'd planned it or something, is the idea that you find in Celtic Christianity of the animkara, or the soul friend, who is the particular person that you go to be completely open and vulnerable with about all of life. So the idea of a soul friend isn't necessarily, well, the idea of having someone isn't necessarily related directly to Celtic Christianity, but it is something different. So there's just a quote on the 18th of December, which you'll read in a few days if you're doing the book, by a chap called Edward Selner, and a book that he wrote called The Celtic Soul Friend. And he said, the belief that there are relationships that can be especially helpful for personal growth and the acquisition of wisdom is not unique to the Celts or Celtic lands. Teachers, mentors, and benevolent helpers have been identified in many spiritual traditions in the history of humankind. The philosopher of the Greeks, the shaman of the native tribes, the rabbi of the Jews, the guru of the Hindus, the Zen master of the Buddhists, the starets of Eastern Orthodox Christians, all of these are considered by their followers as important resources for their spirituality. Still, the Anamkara of the early Celtic church has a unique value of its own, for it came to be closely associated in Christianity with an ongoing transformation, a process of conversion reconciliation that included frequent disclosure to a soul friend. Having a soul friend was significantly important in Celtic Christianity. Having this person that you are fully and openly vulnerable to and honest with was significantly important, so much so that in some of the rules of the monastic centers, there were instructions that either you had to have one, or in the rule of Talot, which is the KDD rule, they had a whole section on how an Anamkara should be and what sort of thing you should do. And it wasn't just someone to kind of fluff you up and go, oh, aren't you lovely? Well done. Or oh, no, that's really hard. And isn't, you know, some of that was there. But actually, in the rule of Talot, it says you need to find someone who will make the fire in you burn hotter and brighter. You've got to find someone who challenges you to be a better person, not just someone who goes, oh, that's really terrible that you're finding it hard, and let's just make you feel better about yourself. It's a bit like having a physiotherapist. You know, you can either have a physiotherapist, and hopefully this doesn't ever happen, but it's just an example, who goes, oh, well, it's terrible. You know, you're finding it hard to walk and it's hurting your legs because you've had a bad accident or something. You know, you've broken your legs. But that's okay, because, you know, lots of people have broken legs and lots of people can't walk. So don't worry too much about it. You know, just be okay with that. It's fine. Or you have a physiotherapist who goes, I know it's hurting, but let's do another stretch of walking. Because actually what we want to do is to get your legs better. And as we go through life, we will come to points where we need somebody else. We are designed to be interdependent, not independent. It's a lie of Western culture that we are supposed to be independent and be able to stand on our own two feet. That is nonsense. We're not supposed to be dependent on others completely, but we are supposed to be interdependent. that means that we can do stuff for ourselves, but we have limits. We learn our limits. And when we get to our limits, we ask for help. And to have someone there already structured and organized to be that help, to be there with you as you walk, that's really, really useful. So how do we prepare ourselves for the coming of Christ, who didn't turn up at 7:15, but could be 8:15? How do we prepare ourselves? How do we live those lives that are ready for the return of Christ? Well, one of the ways is to have a structure set up that's going to help us, a rule, if you want to call it that, a way of life. And one of them is to have others around us to help us. The people we've already spoken of who were inspirations in our past, to have those people ready and set. So that's how the Celts prepared themselves for the coming of Christ at the end of all things.